All right, we're underway with our recorder. So again, we're picking it up on page 171, chapter 8, verse 10. Chapter 8, verse 10. So we're in chapter 8 of the book of Daniel. Now, as far as chapter 8 goes, when we began chapter 8 in verse 1, we were in the prophet's present time, the very end of the Babylonian exile. And Daniel received a vision at that time in which he was projected into the near future in verses 2 through 4. He was projected into the Persian period, the near future. In that vision, he was transported from Babylon where he was living. Remember, he was a high official in the Babylonian government. He was transported 230-some miles east to Shushan or Susa in the province of Elam. Now, Shushan was just a out of the way, run-of-the-mill town at that time. However, it was destined to become the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so Daniel recognized the town, and then he saw the palace that had not yet been built. And this is the archaeological excavations there at Shushan and Darius's palace that was in the future, that wasn't even built at the time that Daniel was actually living, but he could see it in the future when he was transported in this vision. Now, in the vision, he saw a goat, and this goat butted, or this, let's see, ram or a goat? I got to get that straight here. That was a
ram.
It was a ram, okay. Got to get these animals straight. And the ram butted to the east, which spoke of the Medo-Persian expansion to the east through Turkey, Asia Minor there, even into Europe, a little foothold in Europe. It butted to the north, speaking of the Medo-Persian expansion northward to Armenia and Scythia, and it butted to the south, again, speaking of the Medo-Persian expansion into Egypt and Ethiopia. So we saw the expansion of the Medo-Persian Empire to its greatest extent. Then in verse 5, Daniel was projected a little further into the future, into the Greek period, into the far future, and verses 5 through 22 dealt with the Greek period. Here we saw this this goat with one horn coming across the earth at great speed and attacking the ram. And that animal signified the Hellenistic Empire. The horn in the center of its head signified Alexander the Great, the young leader of the Hellenistic Empire. And here's one of those, that mosaic illustrating Alexander the Great at the Battle of Issus.
Is that a horn?
No, that's just some of the background. No, yeah, that's the guy behind him, okay? Now, remember these verses, verse 5 through 22, expanded our information about the third segment of the image we saw in chapter 2. The third segment was the belly and thighs of brass, which spoke of the Hellenistic kingdom and its government of democracy. This section also expanded the information we received about the Hellenistic Empire in chapter 7, where it was portrayed as a four-winged, four-headed leopard. And then we traced Alexander's 12-year career of conquering the Medo-Persian Empire, starting up in Macedonia and Greece, working down through Israel, over to Babylon, up to the northern end of the kingdom, and then back to Babylon where he died. He died in Babylon here at age 32, 12 years after starting. So he had quite a career, but it didn't last too long. After he died, his empire was divided up among his four generals. After 20 years, the boundary lines finally settled down to General Cassander taking charge of Macedonian Greece, General Lysimachus taking charge of Thrace and Bithynia, Ptolemy taking charge of Egypt and Israel, and Seleucus taking charge of all points to the east, leaving Israel dead center in the middle between Seleucus and Ptolemy, and this would have a major effect on Jewish history, as we will see in just a few minutes. Moving ahead to verse 21 and 22, very clearly the shaggy goat represents Alexander and the Hellenistic kingdom. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king, that's Alexander. The broken horn, that's the death of Alexander. And the four horns, that's his four generals, that arose in its place represent the four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. And that's exactly what happened, as we've seen just a moment ago. Then a small horn appeared out of one of the horns, and this was a reference to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphany. And we learned at the end of those, in the middle of verse of chapter 8, that this man would persecute the Jewish people. So let's pick it up in verse 10 on page 171. Let's review verse 10 very quickly in chapter 8. So page 171, the middle of the page, chapter 8, verse 10. It, speaking of the, it grew up in the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. Now, as we move through your outline, we saw that the host of heaven in some places speaks of God's angelic host, angelic army, but in other places it speaks of Israel. And here, as we'll see in verse 12, it speaks of the Jewish people. Then point C at the bottom of the page, we learn that he would persecute the Jews, and when he did, he would be coming up against the angelic host, who are the protectors of Israel. So attacking Israel means taking on Israel's guardian angel. All right, page 172 is the new material. Now, at the top of page 172, verse 10 continues, point 2 at the very top. Some of the host and of the stars it cast down to the ground and trampled them. And we noted last week that there's a historical record of the fulfillment of these prophecies in the book of 1 Maccabees. And I explained to you what the book of 1 Maccabees, there's actually five books of Maccabees, what they consist of, what they're like, and gave you a handout on that. So we have some excerpts from 1 Maccabees recording the historical fulfillment of the events talked about in verse 10. So let's pick it up on point A, 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 29 through 32. Here's how it worked out in history. And this is the only record that I know of that we have. And 2 years had fully expired, the king sent his chief collector of tribute unto the cities of Judah, who came unto Jerusalem with a great multitude, and spoke peaceable words unto them. But all was deceit. For when they had given him credence, he fell suddenly upon the city, and smote it very sore, and destroyed much people of Israel. And when he had taken the spoils of the city, he set it on fire, and pulled down the houses and walls thereof on every side. But the women and children took they captive and possessed the cattle. So that's the beginning of the persecution against the Jewish people. Dropping down five more verses in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, we pick it up at point B in verse 37. Thus they shed innocent blood on every side of the sanctuary. And the sanctuary, of course, is the temple. This would be the second temple built by Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, the post-exilic temple. So they shed innocent blood on every side of the sanctuary and defiled it, inasmuch that the inhabitants of Jerusalem fled because of them. Now note that. We're going to see a parallel to that in a little while. The inhabitants of Jerusalem fled because of them, whereupon the city was made a habitation of strangers and became strange to those who were born to her, and her own children left her. The historical description of verse 10 continues on page 173, dropping down to verse 41 of chapter 1 of 1 Maccabees. Point C there. Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and everyone should leave his laws, So all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. So King Antiochus loved Hellenism. He thought it was the superior form of culture and government. So he decreed that everyone should be a Hellenist, that everyone should leave his laws, meaning their own personal laws, the laws of their land, the laws of their government, the laws of their gods, and follow Greek mythology and Hellenism. That's the idea there. Now, for the heathen, that's an easy thing to do. Just trade in one god for another. So all the heathen agreed, okay, we'll all become Hellenists. Great, no big deal. Will Jews do that? Nah, we won't do that kind of thing. Point D, 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 48 through 50. Here are some of the laws that we were commanded to break. They should also leave their children uncircumcised and make their souls abominable with all matter of uncleanness and profanation, to the end that they might forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whosoever would not do according to the commandment of the king should die. So circumcision was outlawed. That's kind of like outlawing witnessing for Christians. It comes with the territory. And then, of course, the laws regarding cleanness and uncleanness, etc. The Torah, the Mosaic Law, was all challenged. And anyone who followed the Mosaic Law was under the threat of death. And that's exactly what happened. And dropping down 10 verses in 1 Maccabees to chapter 1, verses 60 and 61, point E, we do read about that. At which time, according to the commandment, they put to death certain women that had caused their children to be circumcised. And they hanged about their necks and rifled their houses and slew them that had circumcised them. So apparently these mothers they executed along with their children and then put them on public display, the bodies up on public display, and then killed the men that performed the circumcision and robbed their houses. And finally, 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 64 kind of sums it up Succinct statement, yeah. There was very great wrath upon Israel, to say the least. There was very great wrath upon Israel. So remember, the book of Maccabees are not inspired books. They're not part of the Jewish or Christian, I should say, not part of the Jewish or Protestant canon. The Roman Catholic Church has incorporated some of these books into their canon. They're extra-biblical historical books that record the details of the persecution mentioned in verse 10. So we get a little glimpse through the historian into the fulfillment of verse 10. All right, page 174. Top of the page, we now look at the abomination of desolation in verses 11 and 12. Okay, everybody there? Question. Do I what? Yes, I do have it on. Yeah, it's on. Oh, there's a bit of an echo. You want me to turn the other one down? Okay, the other one needs to come down then. All right, is that any better? Is that any better there? I've turned that one down. Okay. All righty. Chapter 8, verses 11 and 12 then. It, again, speaking of the little horn, it even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And so point one, the horn magnifies himself. In other words, Antiochus makes claims of deity. And up on the screen, we see the coin of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. The reverse shows Zeus, the king of gods, enthroned, carrying the goddess Nike, victory. And the legend reads, King Antiochus, God manifest. Epiphany, bearing victory. So he's basically said, I am the physical and earthly embodiment of Zeus. And Zeus, or Jupiter, was the top god of the Greek mythological pantheon. So I am Zeus incarnate, God manifest. And of course, that's what epiphany means. You have an epiphany, you know, a revelation comes to you, you understand things. That's it, God manifesting himself. So he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. Point 2a, the host here is Israel. We saw that back in verse 10. So the prince or the leader of the host would be the high priest. The high priest was the highest official in the Jewish government. And so he did magnify himself against the prince of the host by replacing high priests at will. And he replaced them without regard to the Mosaic law. So a legitimate high priest will be deposed. We'll see that in a few minutes. And illegitimate priests who would do Antiochus' bidding were put in place. So he did magnify himself against the governmental, Israel's government. Point three, it, the horn again, took away from him, that would be the prince, the continual burnt offering. He stopped the sacrificial system, and that's recorded in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 44 and 45, right there in the middle of the page. For the king had sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple. So 1 Maccabees records the fact that the Mosaic sacrificial system was forbidden in the temple. So Antiochus does all he can to wipe out the Mosaic law. Okay, page 175, top of the page. Verses 11 and 12 read that the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Now that term cast down means to desecrate. The temple was desecrated by Antiochus and his Greek soldiers. And again, it's recorded in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 21 and 20 through 23. They entered proudly into the sanctuary and took away the golden altar and the candlestick of light and all the vessels thereof and the table of showbread and the pouring vessels and the vials and the censers of gold and the veil and the crowns and the golden ornaments which were before the temple, all of which he pulled off. He took also the silver and the gold and the precious vessels. Also he took the hidden treasures which he found. So in a sentence, Antiochus stripped the temple. He stripped the temple bare. Now you guys have seen these pictures before, although a number of you are new students and haven't seen all these pictures, so I'm going to run through it for all the new students. So if you've seen all these pictures, just please be patient. I'll be showing you temple furniture that the Temple Institute in Jerusalem has constructed for use in the third temple. And by looking at these implements, we get an idea of what Antiochus stripped out of the second temple. This is the temple menorah. This he stripped out of the temple, made of gold. The table of showbread looks like this. And again, it's wood covered with gold. The golden altar of incense that's in the holy place, that was taken from the temple. A vessel such as this cleaning vessel for the lampstand would be a sample of the type of vessels that he would rifle. Here's an incense chalice. Again, this is going to be used in the third temple. Measuring cups, we read about those in 1 Maccabees, the pouring vessels. So here we have brass measuring cups for use in the temple. The mitzrach. The mitzrach were used to catch the blood from the sacrifices and then dash the blood against the corner of the altar and pour it out of the base of the altar. So those were taken. Vessels for the water libation. When the water was poured out on the altar, these vessels were used. When the wine libation was poured out on the altar, here's a decanter for that wine offering, a drink offering. Even things like silver shovels, the pretty mundane instruments, they're used to clean the altar of the ashes but they're made out of silver. So they were taken by Antiochus. And musical instruments, such as this biblical harp, would have been stolen by him. Musical instruments used by the Levites in their song service. And silver trumpets, items like these. Again, all these items are ready to go for the third temple. And these are the kind of items that Antiochus took out of the second temple. All righty, the desecration of the temple is further described in point C. In the middle of the page, 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 39. The sanctuary was laid waste like a wilderness. Her feasts were turned into mourning, her Sabbaths into reproach, her honor into contempt. As had been her glory, so was her dishonor increased, and her excellency was turned into mourning. And then the next segment at the bottom of your outline, point D, we drop down to verse 45 of 1 Maccabees. And the Jewish people were commanded that they should profane the Sabbaths and the festival days, pollute the sanctuary and holy people, set up altars and groves and chapels of idols, and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beasts. And so Hellenistic worship is promoted throughout Jerusalem and throughout the land of Israel, again enforced by the soldiers of Antiochus Epiphanes. Page 176, top of the page, point E. You should star point E. Point E, 1 Maccabees 1, verses 54 through 55, regards the setting up of the abomination of desolation. So this is a very important historical record that you ought to be aware of. The problem here is that the Christian church is in a main ignorant of this history. We Jews know this history very well. We're very familiar with this, but the church is not. And so I'm very glad that Dr. Fruchtenbaum has put in excerpts from the Book of Maccabees. It's a very important part of Jewish history. All right, point E, the paragraph reads, "Now the 15th day of the month of Kislev, in the 145th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar." And that would be a statue of Zeus, a statue of Jupiter. So they set up this idol on God's altar. "And they builded idol altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side. And they burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets." So we see this idolatry imposed upon the Jewish people again. Point F, verse 59. "Now the 25th day of the month, they did sacrifice upon the altar, the idol altar, which was upon the altar of God." And so this pagan image and this pagan altar was erected on top of the Jewish altar and sacrifices offered upon it, desecrating the temple. Sacrifices to Zeus. And then in the book of 2 Maccabees, chapter 6, some more details are revealed to us. Point G, 2 Maccabees, chapter 6. "Not long after this, the king sent an old man of Athens to compel the Jews to depart from the laws of their fathers and not live after the laws of God, and to pollute also the temple in Jerusalem and to call it the temple of Jupiter Olympius." So here they want to rename the temple, dedicate it to Jupiter, the top god of Greek mythology. "This coming in of this mischief was sore and grievous to the people, for the temple was filled with riot and reveling by the Gentiles, who dallied with harlots and had to do with women within the circuit of the holy places, and besides that brought in things that were not lawful, and the altar also was filled with profane things which the law forbid." And so now the Greek soldiers practiced ritual prostitution in the temple courts. And of course, we know this is very common from the New Testament in many of the letters of Paul. He deals with concerns regarding temple prostitution throughout the Greek-dominated world. So it was then practiced here in the temple. All right, page 177. Point 5 at the top of page 177. Verse 12 goes on to state that the host was given over to it. The host was given over to the little horn. And so the host is Israel. So the little horn is Antiochus. And he did, point A, he did have victory over the Jewish community. And many died in the persecution. And he succeeded in stopping the burnt offering. Point 6, the burnt offering was given over to him, so true worship was stopped, and the pagan worship system instituted. And all this came about, point 7, through transgression, through sin, through a deliberate breaking of God's law. That's what a transgression is, breaking a law. And the transgression was instituted by two groups of people. Point A, the first group is that of Antiochus and his fellow Greeks, his army. They instituted the setting up of the Greek worship system. But the second group that supported this persecution is point B, the Hellenists. Now, who are the Hellenists? The Hellenists are Jewish people who embraced Greek culture. These were Jewish people that wanted to go along with the program. And their influence is recorded in 1 Maccabees as well. Point 1, verses 11 and 12. In those days went there out of Israel wicked men. So these are Jewish people who persuaded many, saying, let us make a covenant with the heathen that are around us, round about us. For since we departed from them, we have had much sorrow. And so this device pleased them well. So these Jewish people said, hey, let's cooperate with the program here. When we don't cooperate with the program, we just get persecuted. So let's go along with it. It'll be a lot easier on us. And many people liked that idea. And so point 2, we drop down to verse 43 of 1 Maccabees chapter 1, point 2 at the bottom of the page. Yea, many of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath. And so, again, the Jewish people begin to practice idol worship. The very thing that caused us to be exiled to Babylon in the first place.
But didn't that continue at the time of Christ? Wasn't there Hellenists?
Yes, there were Hellenists, but they weren't necessarily idol worshippers. The Hellenists usually in the New Testament refer to Jews who are living in the diaspora. They didn't necessarily, they weren't necessarily following Greek mythology. Remember, the Hellenists came into Jerusalem for the Passover, became believers, stayed, and then there was the problem with the Israeli widows and the Hellenists weren't getting the supply of the food, and so the first deacons were set up. Well, those were Greek-speaking Jews, Jews living in the diaspora, who were still loyal to the God of Israel. They would come in for the Passover. Paul was a Hellenist. He grew up in Tarsus. You know, he came in, became a Pharisee. So the Hellenists here are wicked men, people who abandon the law. So keep that straight. Yeah, that's a good point, Don. Good point. Question?
Just a little clarity on 12. Because of the transgression and sin, an army was given over to the horn. Is that army Israel given over to Antiochus?
Where are you? Page 177. Are you reading your in your text? Okay, and what text do you have? What version?
New King James.
New King James. Okay. It would be better to render that the host will be given over to them. They're making a, the King James translator there are making a theological decision that the host refers to the host of heaven, the armies of heaven, so they're calling it the armies were given over to them. It's the host of heaven.
And it's not Israel.
It is Israel. Sometimes the host of heaven refers to the angelic armies.
Oh, okay.
And here in this context, however, and in other contexts, it refers to Israel.
Okay.
So the host is given over to him. The Jewish people are given over to him.
The horn is
Antiochus. Yes, the little horn is Antiochus. Say again. Do they still exist? Who? No. The Hellenist parties are pretty much gone now. Yeah. Question, Bonnie.
Don't you think that maybe they call it the host here because Israel was the host country?
No, Israel is called the host of heaven in other sections of Scripture. It's just a reference to the Jewish people. Yeah. It just means the large group. An army, the host of heaven. Here it's the people.
Do you know how many people were in Israel at the time?
No, I don't know the. Yeah, I don't know the population. Yeah.
20%?
Well, there was a large Jewish population living in Babylon. We know that about 50,000 came back in the return. But how large the population had grown at this time, that I couldn't say. Okay. All righty. All right, page 178, top of the page, point 8. The text goes on to say, it, the horn, cast down the truth to the ground. Now, the truth specifically here is the law of Moses. Generally, the truth is the Hebrew Bible in general, generically. Psalm 119, 160 is a good cross-reference there. The sum of your word is truth. We also learn in other sections of Scripture that God is a God of truth. And Jesus, of course, said of himself, I am the way and the truth and the life. Now, the question we have to ask ourselves is this. If the truth is cast down in our day, what are we going to do? Are we going to be like the Hellenists and say, well, at best we better go along with the program? Yeah, well, many churches have been, yeah. Or are we going to be like the Maccabees who say, we're going to stand for truth?
Amen.
You know, the battle out there is a truth battle. That's the key. It's a truth battle. Do we trust the truth? Do we align ourselves with the truth? That's the real issue. Well, at this point, we in America have not been called upon to stand for the truth, at least not in as dramatic a way as this, a soldier standing over us. But it could happen. It could happen. It happens in other places in the world. You know, there's plenty of believers suffering persecution in other places of the world. They're learning to stand for the truth. Now, I hate to say it, but I've said it for many years, what the United States, the church in the United States needs is a good bit of persecution. We really do need that to separate the wheat from the chaff and to find out where we stand. Now, that's not something I enjoy contemplating at all. But really, that's what we need. That's what we need. All right, I'm preaching now. All right, let's finish up this page. The record of casting the truth to the ground is recorded in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 56 through 58. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the law, which they found, they burnt them with fire. So it wasn't enough for the Greeks to tear up the Torah scrolls into pieces. They set them aflame. And wheresoever was found any book of the Testament, or if any consented to the law, the king's command was that he should be put to death. Thus they did by their authority unto the Israelites every month, to as many as were found in the cities. Now there's the persecution that comes from standing for the truth. Point 9, the little horn did its pleasure, and as you can see, Antiochus was willful. And 10, it prospered. Antiochus succeeded in turning many from the Mosaic Law. He succeeded in turning many from the Bible. He succeeded in turning many Jewish people to Hellenism, the Hellenism. Now, this desecration of the temple by Antiochus previews another literal fulfillment of a desecration of the temple. Another literal fulfillment which is future to us. Now, the prophecy in Daniel chapter 8 was fulfilled literally, right? We see it right here in 1 Maccabees. Literal fulfillment. Not spiritual, not symbolic, literal. And so we can anticipate that other prophecies of the Bible will be fulfilled literally as well, including this one in Matthew 24, verses 15 through 22. This will not be fulfilled symbolically. It will not be fulfilled allegorically. We can expect it to be fulfilled literally. Here's what Yeshua said. Therefore, when you see what? The abomination of desolation, which was spoken of by who? Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. Notice this little parenthesis. Let the reader understand. Jesus is expecting the reader of this book to be familiar with Daniel. You guys are now familiar with Daniel. When you read that, you should understand what Jesus is talking about. Many in the church haven't got a clue about what's in the book of Daniel, right? Many in the church have no clue, so they have no clue regarding what this is talking about. It's an admonition to us to pay attention to the prophets. Let the reader understand. Something parallel to what happened in the book of Daniel is going to happen again. All right, what does he say? When you see the abomination of desolation in the holy place, then what are you supposed to do? Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. You know, if you hear about the abomination of desolation in the third temple, start running. Don't even go back to the other end of the field and get your coat. Head out of town. That's exactly what the Jewish people had to do in the days of the Maccabees, right? We saw that. Yes, question. No, this is in reference to the abomination of desolation in the temple during the tribulation period. In 70 AD, there was no abomination of desolation set up. The temple was destroyed, but nothing was set up in the holy place or on the altar by the Romans. Yeah, the temple was destroyed. This is future. Okay, let's go on. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Now, you ladies know what it would be like if you had to flee from your home 9 months pregnant or a one-month-old little one in your arms. It's going to be tough on them especially. Pray that your flight will not be in the winter when it's raining and cold and miserable, and you have to flee on foot or on the Sabbath when there's no transportation. In Israel, everything shuts down on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. No life would have been saved. Planet Earth would be a desolation. The literal Greek there is all flesh. But for the sake of the elect, and the elect there refers to the faithful remnant of Israel and those Gentiles who become believers during the tribulation as well. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Earth will survive. Israel will survive. So you see the importance of Matthew 24, verses 15 through 22. Let the reader understand. Okay? Reference back to Daniel. All righty, I've kept you 5 minutes past your break, so take a 15-minute break and listen for the shofar. All right, we're back underway, and we're on page 179 as we look at the Little Horn's activities against the Jews. And now on page 179, we learn the time frame, the length of Antiochus' persecution of the Jewish community in verses 13 and 14. So we start with a question in verse 13, chapter 8, verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply, while the transgression that causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? So the question is asked through the appearance of two holy ones, or two angels, one speaking, one giving the answer. And point two, the question is, how long? Basically, how long is this persecution going to last? And that length of time is not from the time frame from verses 3 and 4 when the ram appears, but from the time when the little horn appears in verse 9. It's referring to Antiochus Epiphany. And so how long is the, point B, is the burnt offering going to cease? How long will there be a prohibition against the sacrifices? And point C, how long will the temple be profaned by the abomination of desolation? And that's also repeated in point D. How long will there be a cessation of true worship? How long will the abomination of desolation last in the temple? Page 180 at the top of the page. Verse 14, the answer comes from the other angel. Verse 14, he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. So the answer is 2,300 evenings and mornings. Now some commentators take this to refer to the two daily sacrifices, the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice. And if it deals with the offerings, point A, then it would deal with 1,150 days, because there's two offerings per day. Other commentators take it to refer to two parts of a day, point B, and if it refers to two parts of a day, it then would refer to 2,300 days. So what's the best position to take? The best position is point C. If you look at the Hebrew text, there's no and between the word evening and morning. In my NASB, you see that the word and between evenings and morning is in italics, which means it's been added by the translators for a smoother reading. So literally, the Hebrew reads evening mornings, and an evening morning is the equivalent to one day. So this 2,300 figure refers to 2,300 days. Again, we have an historical record of this period of time, and the historical background is found in 2 Maccabees chapter 4, verses 7 through 50. We won't read all those verses, Dr. Fruchtenbaum has provided a summary of what happened. So you're all with me, point D1. In 173, Onias III, who was the righteous high priest, was replaced by Jason. Jason was an Hellenist. He was his brother. And Jason received the position by bribing Antiochus. So he said, kick my brother out from being the high priest. I'll do a good job for you. And here's a bunch of dough to prove it. So the legitimate high priest was removed. The prince of the host. Remember we read last session that the prince of the host would be given into his hand. So he removed the righteous high priest, the correct high priest, from his position. Then in 172, Jason was replaced by Menelaus. Menelaus was also a family member, a brother, and he was also a Hellenist. And he also got the position by bribing Antiochus. So I'll do a better job for you, and here's a little more money to prove it. Page 181. Top of page 181, we have point 3. In 171, Onias III, who was the legitimate high priest, was murdered by Menelaus. He didn't like to have his brother around. So he had his brother murdered. And so illegitimate priests ruled until 164 when Antiochus died. Antiochus died in 164. Also, excuse me? How did he die? He died in Persia, I believe, trying to rifle a pagan temple, I believe is the report. He was trying to conquer a pagan temple and rob it and was killed. Point 4, we also learn from 2 Maccabees the date of the abomination of desolation. Kislev 25, 168 B.C. That was the date in which a pig was slaughtered on the altar underneath the statue of Jupiter. And so the temple was defiled. That's a disgusting thing in God's sight. And so his temple was considered desolate, disgusting to him. It had to be cleansed. But point 2, in the middle of the page, comes the promise that the sanctuary will be restored. So our date of Kislev 25, 168, is the termination point of the 2,300 days. Now, we learn that the sanctuary was cleansed on Kislev 25, 165 B.C., 3 years later after the abomination of desolation was set up in 168, 3 years to the day it was restored and cleansed. So, to find the starting point of this time period, we need to just back up 2,300 days from that point. Point C, the fulfillment. So if we back up 2,300 days from Kislev 25, 165 B.C., we come to September 9th, 171 B.C. Now, no one knows exactly what happened on September 9th, 171 B.C. Some commentators think it was the day in which Onias III was murdered, because we know he was murdered in 171. But we have no record that tells us exactly what happened in 171. All we know is that the atrocities did begin in 171 B.C. So the atrocities began in 171 B.C. and ended, point 2 at the bottom of the page, ended on the Gregorian date of December 25th, 165. And, of course, that date would become the date of Christmas, traditionally. And so this is the beginning of the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, which is celebrated in December each year. And the interesting part is it happened the 25th of Kislev and the 25th of December both fell on the same day in that year, different calendars. All right, page 182. Question. Yes. Yes, they were in the line, but they were not the legitimate high priest. Onias was the legitimate one. They were all the same family. All right, page 182, point D at the top. We have a record of the fulfillment of this section. And it's found in two places. First of all, 1 Maccabees 4, which we don't have in the outline, but which we will read part of in just a moment. So let's read the other historical record, 2 Maccabees 10, verses 1 through 9. Now Maccabees and his company, the Lord guiding them, recovering the temple and the city. So this is the cleansing of the temple. But the altar which the heathen had built in the open street and also in the chapels they pulled down. And having cleansed the temple, they made another altar, and striking stones they took fire out of them and offered a sacrifice after 2 years and set forth incense and lights and showbread. When that was done, they fell flat down and besought the Lord that they might come no more into such troubles. But if they sinned any more against him, that he himself would chasten them with mercy, and they might not be delivered into the blasphemous and unto the blasphemous and barbarous nations. They're saying what Daniel said, what David said: it's better to fall into the hands of the living God than to fall in the hands of men. Now, upon the same day that the strangers profaned the temple, on the very same day it was cleansed again, even the 25th day of the same month, which is Kislev. And they kept 8 days with gladness, as in the Feast of the Tabernacles, remembering that not long, page 183, that not long afore, they had held the Feast of Tabernacles when they wandered in the mountains and dens like beasts. So when the Maccabees were out as guerrilla fighters defeating the Greeks, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles. Therefore they bare branches and fair boughs and palms also, and sang psalms unto him that had given them good success in cleansing his place. And they ordained also by a common statute and decree that every year those days should be kept of the whole nation of the Jews, and thus was the end of Antiochus called Epiphany. It was the end of Antiochus called Epiphany, and it was the beginning of Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication, the Feast of Hanukkah. So this is the historical record of the institution of that feast. It's not a feast commanded in the Law of Moses, but the events of that feast are predicted in the book of Daniel. Yes?
Josephus, doesn't he report much of this?
That I couldn't tell you. Probably Josephus records the history of the Jews, so I would expect him to. Now, there is a traditional story about the beginning of the Feast of Hanukkah, dealing with the miracle of the lights and the oil. But that is not recorded in any historical book. This miracle story is a rabbinic legend. It's the most popular a story about the origin of Hanukkah, but apparently it's not true. It's simply a legend. Most people hate me when I bring that up, because it is a nice tradition, but it isn't true. Here is the tradition, and you can look it up on Wikipedia if you'd like, but they summarize it very nicely here. According to the Talmud, olive oil was needed for the menorah in the temple, which was required to burn throughout the night every night. But there was only enough oil to burn for only one day. Yet miraculously, it burned for 8 days, the time needed to prepare a fresh supply of oil for the menorah. An 8-day festival was declared by the Jewish sages to commemorate this miracle. So that's the traditional origin of the 8 days of Hanukkah. Apparently, it's not in the book of Maccabees. The origin of the Feast of Hanukkah is, you just read it here in your notes. It was because they were imitating the Feast of Tabernacles. That's why they made it 8 days. Okay? What about Santa Claus? Hey, wait a second, buddy. You're getting mixed up here. Now, Hanukkah is celebrated today by the Jewish community, and lights are lit, and the Hanukkah menorah is the symbol of Hanukkah. This is called the Hanukkiah. And the Hanukkiah has eight branches, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You can see them there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then the center branch is called the Shamash, or the servant. And the servant candle lights the eight candles. And one candle is lit every day, one for the first day, two for the second day, third for the third day, etc., until you get all eight candles lit during the week of Hanukkah. So that's a traditional kind of menorah. Yes?
Is this based on anything?
No, this is strictly rabbinic legend. Yeah.
So it's kind of like when they made it Kwanzaa.
Yeah. It's just something. Yeah, it is. It's a nice little thing, but there doesn't seem to be any historical fact behind it. And here is a more modern Hanukkiah, and you can see the candles lit there. See, what do we have over here? What is that? That's a Hanukkiah, right. Eight branches and the shamash in the middle. Eight branches with the shamash in the middle. So that one over on the mantle is a Hanukkiah. And what is this one right here? That's a temple menorah right there, because it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 with the shamash in the middle. Now that temple menorah also says Yeshua. It's also the Hebrew letters for Yeshua. Josh put that together for us. Okay. Yeah, and you've got a copy. Yeah, I've got one at home too. You're in the minority, right? Yes. Now you can see in our picture here, you can see a dreidel down here, and you can see gelt. And you can see a present. Now, all of that is part of the paraphernalia of celebrating Hanukkah in America today. And there's legends about the dreidel here. But this is not a story. This is not a study in the Feast of Hanukkah. So we're not going to explain all that stuff to you. But it's a legend. Yeah. Now, there's a second kind of menorah that is used by the Jewish community called the Temple menorah. Now, this is the menorah that stands in front of the Knesset in Jerusalem. And you can see the temple menorah is different in that it has six branches, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and in the center is the shamash. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and the center stem is the shamash. So that's the menorah that burns in the holy place of the temple. The Hanukkiah is used for totally different celebration. It's not to be used in the temple. God designed the temple menorah to have six branches. And so that's the menorah that will be lit in the temple. It is also the emblem of the state of Israel. You've seen the shield of the state of Israel. There it is, the temple menorah. And that is a reproduction of the temple menorah that is found on the Arch of Titus in Rome. And that's the only record we have of a temple menorah. And so it probably looked like that. The Romans carved it into the Arch of Titus to celebrate their sack of the temple in 70 AD. And, of course, this is the temple menorah that the Temple Institute has put together for use in the Third Temple, in the Tribulation Temple. So there's a difference between the temple menorah and the Hanukkiah. Okay, it makes sense? That's about 5 feet tall. Yeah, that's the proper dimensions. It's about 5 feet tall. Okay. Now, at this point, I want to hand out that section of 1 Maccabees that was not included in your notes, because there's a very interesting little event that's found in this account. We won't read all of this account, but we will read about... half of it, and then we'll tie it into the New Testament. Question? The Hanukkah menorah got started with rabbinic tradition. Sometime after the events of the actual historical events. Because the rabbis wanted to celebrate the historical events, but they kind of embellished upon it. There's much more. You need some more here? There's many more traditions besides the one I showed you. But again, that way, that's a study of Hanukkah. Everybody got it here? We got extra here, extra here, extra here. Okay. Everybody got their copy? All righty. Let's read through part of this paragraph, and then we'll tie it into the New Testament. A very fascinating little aside here. All right, 1 Maccabees 4, 39 through 59. Again, we'll read about a third of it. Everybody there? Okay, then said Judas and his brethren, "Behold, our enemies are discomfited. Let us go up to cleanse and dedicate the sanctuary." Upon this, all the hosts assembled themselves together and went up to Mount Zion. And when they saw the sanctuary desolate and the altar profaned and the gates burned up and the shrubs growing in the courts as in a forest or in one of the mountains, yea, the priests' chambers pulled down, they rent their clothes and made great lamentation and cast ashes upon their heads. And they fell down flat to the ground upon their faces and blew an alarm with the trumpets and cried toward heaven. Then Judas appointed certain men to fight against those who were in the fortress until he had cleansed the sanctuary. So he chose priests of blameless conversation, such as had pleasure in the law, who cleansed the sanctuary and bore out the defiled stones to an unclean place. Now, starting with the word "and," mark the next few sentences. The word "and" there. Just put a line under it or something. Okay, everybody there with the word "and"? You see that? And when they consulted what to do with the altar of burnt offerings, which was profaned, they thought it best to pull it down. Remember, this is the altar that had the statue of Jupiter up on it. They thought it best to pull it down, lest it should be a reproach to them, because the heathen had defiled it. Wherewith they pulled it down and laid up the stones in the mountain of the temple in a convenient place until there should come a prophet to show what should be done with them. End of your mark. Okay, that's the section I want you to be aware of. Now, the stones of the altar were torn down and stored up on the Temple Mount somewhere. And we know exactly where. Well, close to exactly where. Here is a diagram of the temple according to the Talmud. And the Talmud tells us that the stones were in a chamber associated with the chamber of the hearth. Now, here's the chamber of the hearth. You can see that? Now, if you could read this drawing, and you could read note number 14, because you would say the chamber of the defiled stones of the altar. All right, now let's take a close-up of the chamber of the hearth. Here's a close-up. There's number 14, that chamber. That chamber is the chamber of the defiled altar stones. Okay, we know exactly where they were placed. Now, this is one diagram of the temple. There's another possibility. Here is a diagram of the temple done by Rittmeyer. Now, in this diagram, the temple's facing the opposite direction. But in Rittmeyer's drawing, here is the chamber of the hearth with four chambers around it. Let's get a close-up. Here is the chamber of the hearth, and here is the chamber of the defiled altar stones. Okay, so we know approximately where these stones were kept. Here's a model of the temple looking at the north side. And this picture shows all the buildings. The defiled altar stones were either kept in this building, which is the chamber of the hearth, or in that building, which is the chamber of the hearth. We don't know exactly which building it was, but we do know that these stones were kept there. And even in the Cartas Encyclopedia of the Holy Temple, the rabbis call that chamber the chamber of the seals, and they have an illustration of that chamber, and guess what's in the corner here? There they are. There's the defiled altar stones, according to the Cartas Encyclopedia of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. So it was thought that these stones were up on the Temple Mount, in the temple, as part of the temple complex in the first century. Now, why in the world am I bringing all this out? Well, I want you to take a look at John chapter 10. Write this down as a cross-reference at the bottom of your page there. John chapter 10, verses 22 through 39. We have a very, very interesting incident in the life of Jesus that very well may relate to these altar stones. All right, John 10, 22 through 39. Let's read it. At that time, the feast of what? Dedication, Hanukkah. The feast of dedication took place at Jerusalem. We just read about its origin, right? It was winter, December, right? Okay, everything makes sense, right? And Jesus was what? He was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon. All right, here's the temple complex. This is the portico of Solomon, all along the eastern side. So Jesus was teaching somewhere in this covered colonnade, somewhere along in here. Now, what happens as he's teaching? The Jews then gathered around him. That would be the Pharisees. And they were saying to him, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly." Kind of ridiculous. For 3.5 years, he's been claiming to be the Messiah. They still want more proof. Okay, I've edited out the middle section, and we're down to verse 39. He states, "I and the Father are one." A clear claim to deity, right? The reaction of the Pharisees. The Jews picked up, the literal Greek says, carried stones again to stone him. Therefore, they were seeking again to seize him, and he eluded their grasp. Now, when you stone somebody in Israel, you didn't pick up little stones in your hand like this, okay, and toss it at the person. What you did is you pushed the person off a 10-foot drop. If they survived the fall, that you then carried large stones over and you dropped the large stones on their chest or head. Okay, 10-foot drop. That's how they were killed, okay? So this section of Scripture very adequately and accurately describes that. The Jews literally carried stones to stone him. Okay, it was a burden, these stones. All right, now, how does this relate to what's going on? Jesus is here in the portico of Solomon. The defiled altar stones are somewhere over here. Exactly which building, we're not sure, but right in that area. Could it be? Well, let me ask another question. Where would you get stones of adequate size to stone Jesus? Well, the temple was still under construction, so some commentators feel that there might have been a pile of stones somewhere on the Temple Mount. But while that's a possibility, the temple was kept very clean. It wasn't, you didn't have workmen stones all over the place. You might have had them in a corner someplace. So that's a possibility. But I want to share with you another possibility. Is it possible that the Pharisees that heard Jesus say, "I and the Father are one," left the portico of Solomon, went over to where the defiled altar stones were kept, carried some of those stones back to where Jesus was, and notice, right here, you have the Golden Gate. That's the eastern gate to the temple. And if you can see it, there's stairs leading up to that gate. Could they have brought those stones over there and planned to push Jesus out of that gate and off those stairs where he would fall about 10 feet to the ground and then drop the stones on him? Is it a possibility? Yeah, it is a possibility.
Because they would be defiled if they were to touch the stone.
No, it was in the temple. The stones were in the temple.
They would get hernias. They would
get hernias maybe, but defiled probably not because they were... There's the rub. This is the ironic part. What did your verse in 1 Maccabees say? The stones were placed in the temple at a convenient place until there should come a prophet to show what would be done with them. Who's Jesus? He is the prophet. He is the prophet. He was rejected. What? What do you mean?
Well, if they offended you against
Well, I don't think he was telling them what to do with those stones, because he was God. He was God. Well, he was God. So, no, I don't go with you there, Bonnie. Anyway, I think it's a fascinating possibility that that's exactly what happened in John chapter 10, that these stones were there on the temple. They were in a location that could have been easily reached, and Jesus was in a location where he could have been stoned in the traditional Jewish manner. So whether that happened or not, I don't know. We'll have to ask the Lord when we see him. Yes?
Would it make sense for them simply to go to that location? I mean, were those stones, I don't want to say that it was sacred, but they obviously had placed them there.
They had placed them there because they didn't want them to be used as the altar. But they obviously were not defiled to the point where they couldn't be up on the Temple Mount and part of the temple complex. They weren't discarded. They were kept there on the temple complex because it's possible the prophet could have said, "We'll reuse them in the altar."
But now they're taking them out of there.
But they're convenient. They're convenient, and this is hypothetical, yes. But it fits the scene.
Seems like you have a disbeliever up there.
Though. No. He's agreeing with me. All right. Now, so much for that. Now, Dr. Constable in his notes, and we'll be done in just a minute or two, inserts a Jewish joke at this point in his notes. And this is the way the Jewish joke goes. A persecutor of the Jews in Russia asked the Jew what he thought the outcome would be if the wave of persecutions continued. The Jew answered, "The result will be a feast. Pharaoh tried to destroy the Jews, but the result was the Feast of Passover. Haman attempted to destroy the Jews, but the result was the Feast of Purim. Antiochus Epiphany tried to destroy the Jews, but the result was the Feast of Dedication." Right? So, how do you sum up Jewish history in three sentences? One, they tried to kill us. Two, God saved us. Three, let's eat. All right. All right. I've kept you guys 6 minutes over, so let me pray and let me turn you guys loose. Father, again, thank you for this section of Scripture and the historical verification that we saw regarding the prophecies in the book of Daniel. Literal verification, literal fulfillment, and so we can anticipate a literal fulfillment in the future. And we look forward to that. But Lord, what about this idea of persecution? If we should ever be faced with the truth being thrown to the ground in our lifetime and before our eyes, what will we do? Lord, I ask that you give us the grace and the strength to stand for the truth, no matter what. I don't like contemplating that idea, but it could happen. And so, Lord, give us all the strength we need to stand for your truth, should you ordain that kind of a situation that the faithful remnant faced in the days of the Maccabees be our fate as well. Help us to take this seriously. And so, Lord, we lift that request up to you, asking for your grace and your strength. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we'll see you guys next.